This is Audible.
Hello and welcome to this audio presentation of Turning Pro by Stephen Pressfield. I'm Stephen Pressfield and I'll be reading it by way of super short introduction. In my book, The War of Art, the central concept is of a powerful self-generated negative force that I call resistance with a capital R. Resistance is constituted of those demons of self-sabotage that all of us who are artists or entrepreneurs are so familiar with. Procrastination, self-doubt, fear, arrogance, laziness, perfectionism, etc. All the negative forces that keep us from doing our work and from becoming the best version of ourselves. Okay, that's resistance. The question then becomes, how do we defeat it? In The War of Art, the middle section is called Turning Pro. That was and is my answer to overcoming resistance. The book you're about to listen to concentrates on that subject and nothing else. How do we stop living our lives as amateurs and start doing our work as pros? I said in The War of Art that I could divide my own life neatly into two parts, before turning pro and after. After is better. One last note before we begin. Portions of some of these chapters appeared on my blog in a slightly different form. So if you hear anything that rings a bell with you, that's what it is. 90% of this material is brand new. So, without further ado, let's plunge into Turning Pro. Book 1, The Amateur Life. Chapter 1, The Human Condition. The Daily Show reported recently that scientists in Japan had invented a robot that is capable of recognizing its own reflection in a mirror. When the robot learns to hate what it sees, said John Stewart, it will have achieved full humanity. 2. Three models of self-transformation. When we hate our lives and ourselves, two models present themselves as modes of salvation. The first is the therapeutic model. In the therapeutic model, we are told, or we tell ourselves, that we are sick. What ails us is a condition or a disease. A condition or a disease may be remedied by treatment. Right now we are ill. After treatment, we will be well. Then we will be happy and will be able to function productively in society and in the world. That's one way of looking at our troubles. The second way is the moralistic model. The moralistic model is about good and evil. The reason we are unhappy, we are told, or we tell ourselves, is that we have done something wrong. We have committed a crime or a sin. In some versions of the moralistic model, we don't even have to have done anything wrong. The human being, we are told, was born wrong. The answer to the condition of wrongness is punishment and penance. When we have served our sentence and atoned for our sins, we will be pardoned and released. Then we will be happy and will be able to function productively in society and in the world. This book proposes a third model. The model this book proposes is the model of the amateur and the professional. The thesis of this book is that what ails you and me has nothing to do with being sick or being wrong. What ails us is that we are living our lives as amateurs. The solution this book suggests is that we turn pro. Turning pro is free, but it's not easy. You don't need to take a course or buy a product. All you have to do is change your mind. Turning pro is free, but it's not without cost. When we turn pro, we give up a life with which we may have become extremely comfortable. We give up a self that we have come to identify with and to call our own. We may have to give up friends, lovers, even spouses. Turning pro is free, but it demands sacrifice. The passage is often accompanied by an interior odyssey whose trials are survived only at great cost, emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually. We pass through a membrane when we turn pro. It hurts. It's messy and it's scary. We tread in blood when we turn pro. Turning pro is not for everyone. We have to be a little crazy to do it or even to want to. In many ways, the passage chooses us. We don't choose it. We simply have no alternative. What we get when we turn pro is we find our power. We find our will and our voice, and we find our self-respect. We become who we always were, but had until then been afraid to embrace and to live out. Do you remember where you were on 9/11? You'll remember where you were when you turned pro. 3. My life as an amateur. When I was in my 20s, I lived for a winter in a boarding house in Durham, North Carolina, that served as a halfway station for patients emerging from state mental hospitals. I wasn't a mental patient myself, but the law of metaphor had brought me to this place as surely as if I had been. The people in the halfway house were by no means crazy. They were as interesting and complex a collection of individuals as I had ever met. I made friends. I found a home. We did a lot of talking in the evenings in the halfway house. We gathered over coffee in the communal kitchen and talked about books and politics and whether aliens were really messengers from the future or from God. I was the only one in the halfway house who had a job. I was making $1.75 an hour in the body shop of a trucking company, training to become an over-the-road trucker. Everyone else in the halfway house got a check from the state. Social workers appeared from time to time to evaluate the people in the halfway house, to check on their progress, and to counsel them in their reintegration into society and the real world. I began to wonder how I came to be in this house with these people. Why did I feel so at home? Was this my destiny? Then one night, I had a dream. In the dream, I came into my room and found that my shirts had all folded themselves in the drawer, instead of being mashed together in their usual jumbled mess. My boots had crawled out from under the bed where I normally kicked them when I took them off, and had set themselves upright and tidy. They had shined themselves. When I woke up, I thought, I'm ambitious. I have ambition. I didn't tell anyone in the halfway house about the dream. In fact, I haven't told anyone to this day. I kept the dream private. It was my secret. It took me a long time to come to terms with the idea that I had ambition. I felt guilty about it. Who was I to aspire to rise above my brothers and sisters or to aim to be better than anyone else? In the halfway house, the dominant emotion was fear. No one ever spoke of it, but fear pervaded every centimeter of that space. Everyone in the house had, in his or her own way, experienced the disintegration of their personality. Everyone had fallen a long way, fallen hard, and fallen alone. Everyone in that house had looked their own annihilation in the face, and it had scared the hell out of them. I decided that I had to leave the halfway house. I found a cinder block cabin along a highway in the country that rented for $15 a week. I still have a photo of that house. The house had no electricity, no toilet, no running water, and no heat. It had a front door, but no back door. There were no windows and no furniture. I slept on a mattress that I pushed into a corner where the rain couldn't reach it. I cooked my meals outdoors and back over a fire of pine kindling that I collected from the woods. I had started driving for the trucking company by then. I was being assigned my first loads and sent out on the road for the first time, so it didn't matter too much where I called home. Most nights I slept in the truck sleeper berth. I ate my meals in cafes and truck stops on the road. The reason I keep a photo of that house is that it changed my life. To find that house and to move into it was my first act as an adult that embraced the idea of ambition. Ambition, I have come to believe, is the most primal and sacred fundament of our being. To feel ambition and to act upon it is to embrace the unique calling of our souls. Not to act upon that ambition is to turn our backs on ourselves and on the reason for our existence. Those first stirrings of ambition saved me and put me on the path to becoming an artist and a professional. 4. My first hero. There was a red-headed cat who used to come around sometimes when I lived in that house in the country. He was a battle-scarred old Tom who lived in the woods. On nights when I was home, I would cook supper over a little fire out back. The cat would materialize and sit across from me while I ate. I tried to toss him scraps of meat from time to time, but he wouldn't take them. He was nobody's pet. The geography of our dinners together was that I would sit on the cinder block step at the back of the house, The fire was in front of me inside a circle of stones on a patch of grass. The wood started 10 feet away. The red-headed cat would sit at the edge of the woods facing me. He didn't lie down. He sat up facing me with his big front paws beneath him. The cat regarded me with an expression that was somewhere between condescension and disdain. There was no doubt in either of our minds which one of us was the superior being or which one possessed self-command and self-sovereignty. There was no doubt which one could take care of himself and which one had his shit together. That cat looked at me as if he was deciding whether or not to kick my ass. I admired that red-headed cat. He became a role model for me. I wanted to be like that red-headed cat. I missed him when he didn't show up. I regarded the apparition of that red-headed cat as a good omen and a sign that maybe I was on the right path. 5. My Smith Corona. What was really happening in that house in the country? What was happening was I was hiding. In the back of my Chevy van, under piles of junk and rusting spare parts, sat my ancient Smith Corona typewriter. Why didn't I throw it away? I certainly wasn't using it. Fear and shame hung over me and over that house, just as they permeated every crack and cranny of the halfway house back in town. I was terrified of sitting down at that Smith Corona and trying to write something, and ashamed of myself because I knew I was terrified, but I was still too scared to act. My ambition was to write, but I had buried it so deep that it only peeked out in dreams and moments of insight that appeared at odd instants and then vanished without a trace. Everything I was doing in my outer life was a consequence and an expression of that terror and that shame. 6. Shadow careers. Sometimes when we're terrified of embracing our true calling, we'll pursue a shadow calling instead. That shadow career is a metaphor for our real career. Its shape is similar, its contours feel tantalizingly the same. But a shadow career entails no real risk. If we fail at a shadow career, the consequences are meaningless to us. Are you pursuing a shadow career? Are you getting your PhD in Elizabethan studies because you're afraid to write the tragedies and comedies that you know you have inside you? Are you living the drugs and booze half of the musician's life without actually writing the music? Are you working in a support capacity for an innovator because you're afraid to risk becoming an innovator yourself? If you're dissatisfied with your current life, ask yourself what your current life is a metaphor for. That metaphor will point you toward your true calling. 7. My shadow career. My shadow career, I've had more than one, was driving tractor trailers. In my late 20s and early 30s, I drove trucks for a living. I drove up and down the East Coast out of Durham, North Carolina, and later cross-country based out of Seaside, California. I was in deadly earnest and committed 100% to making my life as an over-the-road trucker. What I was really doing was running away from writing. Driving trucks was, for me, a shadow version of writing, because being a truck driver was, in my imagination, powerful and manly, just as I imagined being a writer would be. It was interesting, it was never boring, it was a career I could take pride in, an occupation that felt right to me. Driving trucks was honest labor. You worked for a dollar, and you got paid a dollar. The men I drove with were salt-of-the-earth stand-up guys, just as I aspired to be. And it took courage to be a trucker. Rolling over the mountains at night from Western Carolina and Virginia into West Virginia was serious business. Wicked uphills followed drop-dead downhills around breakneck curves, most of them unlighted and unmarked, so that in order to carry speed into the next uphill, which you had to do, or the ascending grade would drop you down into creeper gear with every other trucker on the mountain piling up behind you cursing, you had to keep your right foot nailed to the floor while letting 60,000 pounds of truck and load plunge you downhill as fast as they could. Then there was the romance of the road. I loved the road because it always took you somewhere. You were never stuck in one place. Delivering a load to a factory or a warehouse, I could hang with the locals and shoot the breeze, but I always knew that while they were trapped, I was free. In a few minutes, I'd be clear of town and rolling down the highway. Of course, this was all self-delusion. The road was taking me nowhere. I wasn't writing books. I wasn't facing my demons. I was spectating at life through the movie screen of a cab over windshield, while every mile I traveled only carried me farther away from where I needed to go and from who I needed to become. 8. Three cheers for the amateur life. Before we begin ruthlessly deconstructing the amateur life, let's pause for a moment and give it its due. The amateur life is our youth. It's our hero's journey. No one is born a pro. You've got to fall before you hit bottom, and sometimes that fall can be a hell of a ride. So here's to blackouts and divorces, to lost jobs and lost cash and lost self-respect. Here's to time on the street. Here's to years we can't remember. Here's to bad friends and cheating spouses, and to us too for being guilty of both. Becoming a pro in the end is nothing grander than growing up. What exactly are shadow careers? What is the amateur life? What are addictions and obsessions and displacement activities? How can we learn from them and profit from them when we finally put our days on the street behind us and begin to live our real lives? 9. My Shadow Career, Part 2. When I was in high school, I read a book by Jack Kerouac called On the Road. The book blew my brains out. The beat, bohemian life that Kerouac described was, I thought, the coolest, most romantic thing I had ever heard of. I loved the idea of traveling around the country, working jobs and meeting people and submerging yourself in real life. A lot of other kids read that book and thought the same thing, but very few were dumb enough to actually try to live it. Again, I was getting the writer's life confused with real life. My trucking career was an attempt to professionalize a life on the road. It was not a bad idea, actually. It beat the hell out of my prior years of aimlessly drifting from East Coast to West and North to South, wondering why the life I was living wasn't measuring up to the cool beat times that Jack Kerouac had found. But life is strange and things work out in their own weird way. When I finally did turn pro and started getting books published, my literary agent turned out to be a gentleman named Sterling Lord of Sterling Lord Literistic in New York. Sterling had represented Jack Kerouac. It was Sterling who made the original publishing deal for On the Road. 10. The Shadow Life. In the shadow life, we live in denial and we act by addiction. We pursue callings that take us nowhere and permit ourselves to be controlled by compulsions that we cannot understand or are not aware of, and whose outcomes serve only to keep us caged, unconscious, and going nowhere. The shadow life is the life of the amateur. In the shadow life, we pursue false objects and act upon inverted ambitions. The shadow life, the life of the amateur and the addict, is not benign. The longer we cleave to this life, the farther we drift from our real purpose, and the harder it becomes for us to rally the courage to get back. 11. Addicted to love. I have a friend who's addicted to love. I can relate to this addiction myself. I've known her my whole life, and it's absolutely excruciating to listen to the chronicle of her romances. She migrates from one passionate, all-consuming affair to the next. She is in agony throughout the affair, and the affair always ends in agony. It will not surprise you, I'm sure, when I report that this woman is one of the most gifted, talented people I've ever met. She's a piano prodigy, her photographs win prizes, and she's a near world-class athlete. She has swum the Maui to Big Island open ocean crossing half a dozen times. Over the years, my friend has developed a philosophy. You can almost call it a religion, about pursuing the sublime through love. This philosophy is so complex and so convincing that she can not only persuade herself of its reality, but you and me too if we sit still long enough to listen to her. She is mesmerizing. At the same time, the experience is bone-numbingly tedious, watching her transit from one great love to another, with each story playing out to exactly the same cadence and each one culminating in exactly the same dead end. My friend knows this is resistance. We've talked about it 100 times. She's running away from her gifts, and she knows it. But the habit is too strong. She has become identified with it. It's who she is. 12. Habits. This book is about habits. The difference between an amateur and a professional is in their habits. An amateur has amateur habits, a professional has professional habits. We can never free ourselves from habits. The human being is a creature of habit. But we can replace bad habits with good ones. We can trade in the habits of the amateur and the addict for the practice of the professional and the committed artist or entrepreneur. It may help as a jumping-off place to consider the interior world of the most passionate and tragic creature of habit, the addict. 13. Beautiful losers. Have you ever noticed that addicts are often extremely interesting people? Addiction itself is excruciatingly boring. It's boring because it's predictable. The lies, the evasions, the transparent self-justifications and self-exonerations. But the addict himself is often a colorful and fascinating person. If he has been a substance abuser for any length of time, his story often reads like a novel, packed with drama, conflict, and intrigue. If the addict's drug of choice is alcohol, the narrative is frequently one of job loss, domestic abuse, divorce, abandonment of children, bankruptcy. If class one narcotics are the culprit, the tale often includes troubles with the law, crime, prison time, violence, even death. Of course, you and I can be addicted to a number of things. To love, to sex, to worship of our own children or our parents, to dominance, to submission. We can even be addicted to ourselves. See Charlie Sheen, Donald Trump. Such individuals can be absolutely fascinating at the same time that they're boring as hell. What, then, is the connection between addiction and resistance? 14. Art and Addiction. For the past several years, I've written a weekly post on my website called Writing Wednesdays. Far and away, the most popular entries in that space have been in my Artist and Addict series. One of the points those posts made was that there's not that big a difference between an artist and an addict. Many artists are addicts and vice versa. Many are artists in one breath and addicts in another. What's the difference? The addict is the amateur. The artist is the professional. Both addict and artist are dealing with the same material, which is the pain of being human and the struggle against self-sabotage. But the addict slash amateur and the artist slash professional deal with these elements in fundamentally different ways. When I say addiction, by the way, I'm not referring only to the serious clinical maladies of alcoholism, drug dependence, domestic abuse, and so forth. Web surfing counts too. So do compulsive texting, sexting, twittering, and Facebooking. Distractions. Displacement activities. When we're living as amateurs, we're running away from our calling, meaning our work, our destiny, the obligation to become our truest and highest selves. Addiction becomes a surrogate for our calling. We enact the addiction instead of embracing the calling. Why? Because to follow a calling requires work. It's hard. It hurts. It demands entering the pain zone of effort, risk, and exposure. So we take the amateur route instead. Instead of composing our symphony, we create a shadow symphony of which we ourselves are the orchestra, the conductor, the composer, and the audience. Our life becomes a shadow drama, a shadow startup company, a shadow philanthropic venture. Have you ever been to New Orleans? In Tennessee Williams-esque southern cities, Savannah and Charleston also come to mind, you find characters. The colorful old lady with 39 cats, the purple-haired dude who has turned his apartment into a shrine to James Dean. In the South, you can get away with that stuff. It's kind of cool. The shadow enactment has been elevated to such a level that it becomes folklore, even almost art. My life used to be a shadow novel. It had plot, characters, sex scenes, action scenes. It had mood, atmosphere, texture. It was scary. It was weird. It was exciting. I had friends who were living out shadow movies or creating shadow art or initiating shadow industries. These were our addictions, and we worked them for all they were worth. There was only one problem. None of us was writing a real novel or painting a real painting or starting a real business. We were amateurs living in the past or dreaming of the future while failing utterly to do the work necessary to progress in the present. When you turn pro, your life gets very simple. The Zen monk, the artist, the entrepreneur often lead lives so plain they're practically invisible. Miyamoto Musashi's dojo was smaller than my living room. Things became superfluous for him. In the end, he didn't even need a sword. The amateur is an egotist. He takes the material of his personal pain and uses it to draw attention to himself. He creates a life, a character, a personality. The artist and the professional, on the other hand, have turned a corner in their minds. They have succeeded in stepping back from themselves. They have grown so bored with themselves and so sick of their petty bullshit that they can manipulate those elements the way a hazmat technician handles weapons-grade plutonium. They manipulate them for the good of others. What were once their shadow symphonies become real symphonies. The color and drama that were once outside now move inside. Turning pro is an act of self-abnegation. Not self with a capital S, but little s self. Ego, distraction, displacement, addiction. When we turn pro, the energy that once went into the shadow novel goes into the real novel. What we once thought was real, the world, including its epicenter, ourselves, turns out to be only a shadow. And what had seemed to be only a dream becomes now the reality of our lives. 15. Resistance and addiction. The pre-addictive individual, i.e. you and I when we're young, experiences a calling to art, to service, to honorable sacrifice. In other words, we experience positive aspiration, a vision of the higher, realized self we might become. The intimation of this calling is followed immediately by the apparition of resistance, fear, self-doubt, self-sabotage. What makes this moment so soul precarious is that most of us are unconscious in the event of both our aspirations and our resistance. We're asleep. We know only that something is wrong and we don't know how to fix it. We're restless, we're bored, we're angry. We burn to accomplish something great, but we don't know where to begin, and even if we did, we'd still be so terrified that we couldn't take a step. Enter a drink, a lover, a habit. Addiction replaces aspiration. The quick fix wins out over the long, slow haul. 16. Addiction and shadow careers. When we can't stand the fear, the shame, and the self-reproach that we feel, we obliterate it with an addiction. The addiction becomes the shadow version, the evil twin of our calling to service or to art. That's why addicts are so interesting and so boring at the same time. They're interesting because they're called to something. Something new, something unique, something that we, watching, can't wait to see them bring forth into manifestation. At the same time, they're boring because they never do the work. Instead, the addict enacts his aspiration in shadow form. The addiction becomes his novel, his adventure, his great love. The work of art or service that might have been produced is replaced by the drama, conflict, and suffering of the addict's crazy, haunted, shattered life. 17. The addict as dramatic hero. Robert McKee, in his story seminars, testifies that the essential quality in a fictional protagonist, i.e. the hero in a book or a movie, is that he or she must possess the passion and the will to push the story to the limits of human experience in order to achieve their goal. Otherwise, there would be no story. This heroic monomania is also the definition of the addict. The lush or the junkie will sell her own mother to score the substance she is jonesing for. 18. Why I don't knock addiction. Addictions are not bad. They are simply the shadow forms of a more noble and exalted calling. Our addictions are our callings themselves, only encrypted and incognito. They are a metaphor for our best selves, the coded version of our higher aspirations. Addictions and shadow careers are messages in a bottle from our unconscious. Our self, in the Jungian sense, is trying to get our attention, to have an intervention with us. The question we need to ask of a shadow career or an addiction is the same question the psychotherapist asks of a dream. What is our unconscious trying to tell us? 19. Pulling the pin. When I was 29, I spent a season picking apples in Chelan, Washington. The job sounds idyllic, I know, but it was hard, hard work. It was migrant labor. The season lasted 6 weeks. It started with the Romes, then moved on to the Deliciouses. When the cold started, the wine saps came in. These were the hardest to pick. They cut the flesh of your hands with their sharp, barbed spurs, particularly when you picked them before the sun came up, with frost on the stems and your fingers frozen. One of the top pickers was a guy named Dave, who had been an infantryman with the 1st Marine Division at the Chosin Reservoir in Korea, November to December 1950, when temperatures fell to 30 below zero and the beleaguered American troops were surrounded by 67,000 soldiers of the Chinese 9th Army, one of the most hellish and valiant ordeals in U.S. military history. I asked Dave how he picked wine saps. "With a great deal of pain," he said. Dave was a terrific guy, smart, funny, kind, and generous, who had chosen to live on the fritz, as the Wobblies used to say back in the 20s. He was a drinker who lived most of the year in an SRO hotel on Skid Row in Seattle. The term Skid Row, Dave told me, derived from the original Skid Road in Seattle, where the lumbermen used to slide their timber to the harbor on skids. But he came out on the tramp at harvest time to work the apples in Washington and the cherries in Marysville, California. Dave got a veteran's disability check from Uncle Sam, but he was such a good picker that he could put away a nice wad of cash for winter with a few months' labor in the fall. You get paid by the bin, 4 feet by 4 feet by 3 feet deep, for picking apples. I could do 2 a day when I started, never more than 3. Dave routinely knocked off 6, 7, 8. We got $4 a bin, maybe 6, I can't remember. There was also a $1 a bin bonus at the end of the season if you stuck around. Dave stuck, and so did I. Most of the tramps pulled the pin. What is a tramp, anyway? Dave explained, a tramp is an itinerant worker. A hobo is an itinerant non-worker. A bum is a non-itinerant non-worker. The term pulling the pin comes from the old days of riding the rails. To uncouple one car from another, the train crew pulled a heavy steel pin out of the coupling mechanism. In migrant lingo, pulling the pin meant quitting. You'd wake up and the bunk next to you would be empty. What happened to Jim? He pulled the pin. I could relate to pulling the pin. I pulled the pin on my first book, 99.9% of the way through. I pulled the pin on my marriage. I had never done anything in my life to that point where I hadn't pulled the pin. I was determined now not to pull the pin. I asked Dave why he and everybody else drank wine. Hard liquor will destroy your liver, he said. Good whiskey is expensive and the cheap stuff is poison. Beer? You have to drink a case minimum to get where you need to get. If you don't have a car, how can you carry it? Plus, you're pissing all night long. Wine is best. You can get a decent buzz on a bottle or two, and the stuff is made, at least partly, from a natural product, grapes. Who knows, there might even be a tad of nutrition in there. I was the only person in the bunkhouse who had a vehicle, so I gave everybody rides into town. Mostly they stayed on the orchard, though. Work started at first light. By the end of the day, most of the men were so tired they just wanted to kill a bottle or two and snug down under a blanket. I didn't drink. Instead, I talked to everybody. Jack was probably the coolest of the fruit tramps. He looked like Steve McQueen and was an ace car mechanic, as well as being almost as fast a picker as Dave. He used to cough up blood in such quantities that his pillow couldn't be laundered. They had to throw it away. I asked Jack why he didn't get a real job. He was going to kill himself, it was clear, if he stayed on the road. I tried, man, many times. Last year, my sister's husband took me in back in Enid, Oklahoma, where I'm from. Had a job, nice little apartment, even had a girlfriend. I asked him what happened. One morning I woke up, just couldn't take it no more. Pulled the pin. 20. Pulling the Pin, Part 2. Two things struck me about the migrants in that bunkhouse. First, they were wonderful guys. They weren't crazy, they weren't stupid. They would teach you and help you, they'd share anything down to their last dollar. They were funny and smart. Most of them were readers. A good portion of them kept up with politics and had more insight to contribute than the paid pundits on the airwaves. Second, they had achieved the kind of peace that comes when you've already fallen so far that you don't have to worry about falling any farther. Worst come to worst, Dave or Jack could have slept on the ground, foraged for grub. If the bomb went off tomorrow, they'd survive just fine. There was something very natural, I thought, about a life following the seasons. The human race did that for millions of years. When I finished the season in Washington, the next crop was coming into harvest down in California. You coming for the cherries, Dave asked me. I wanted to. If I hadn't had a book I had to finish, so I could stop pulling the pin, and my cat Mo to look after, I'd have done it. I gave Dave a ride out to the highway. I could see him in my rear view, with his thumb out, heading south as I was going west. The life we call normal isn't normal at all. A spouse and kids, a mortgage, a 9-to-5 job, who said that was life? What's so great about working in a factory or a cubicle? You and I, who are artists and entrepreneurs, live a life that's closer to natural, if you ask me. We migrate, too. We follow the muse instead of the sun. When one crop is picked, we hit the road and move on to the next. It's not a bad life. It's lonely. It's tough. It ain't for everyone. But like the life of a migrant on the road, it has its compensations. Dave may have been a drinker, and he certainly wasn't going to quit. But that was the life he had chosen. Would his mother and father, his sisters, and his ex-wife have picked that kind of life for him? Would he himself have elected it? But Dave was willing to pay the price for the choices he had made. He paid it in hard work and hard times, and the looks people gave him when they passed him on the street. They didn't know Dave. He was a top hand and a good guy. He would never pull the pin. He was a pro. 21. The definition of boring. Something that's boring goes nowhere. It travels in a circle. It never arrives at its destination. The repetitive nature of the shadow life and of addiction is what makes both so tedious. No traction is ever gained, no progress is made, we're stuck in the same endlessly repeating loop. That's what makes addiction like hell. All addictions share, among others, two primary qualities. One, they embody repetition without progress. Two, they produce incapacity as a payoff. 22. The payoff of incapacity. Remember my friend who is addicted to love? She's charming, she's interesting, she's beautiful and adventurous and intelligent. If you saw a story about her in Vanity Fair, you might think, wow, what a brilliant life this woman leads, full of drama and romance and glamour. I wish I had that life. I love my friend, but she has wasted her life. I know because I've wasted vast tracts of my own. My friend has used the pursuit of love to produce incapacity, and it has worked for her for decades. Her multiple talents have gone unexplored, untried, and unrealized. She has become a version of herself, but it is a shadow version, an inverted version, a crippled version. She is miserable, and she cannot or will not change. You might disagree with me. You might say my friend has a great life. You might be right. Distraction and displacement seem innocent on the surface. How can we be harming ourselves by having fun or seeking romance or enjoying the fruits of this big, beautiful world? But lives go down the tubes one repetition at a time, one deflection at a time, 140 characters at a time. The following is a sampling in no particular order of garden variety addictions that fall short of hardcore chemical dependency, but are still more than potent enough to cripple, malform, and destroy our lives. 23. Addicted to failure. There's a difference between failing, which is a natural and normal part of life, and being addicted to failure. When we're addicted to failure, we enjoy it. Each time we fail, we are secretly relieved. There's a glamour to failure that has been mined for centuries by starving poets, romantic suicides, and other self-defined doomed souls. This glamour inverts failure and turns it into quote-unquote success. I've had a romance with this goddess myself. Have you? The lure of failure can be as intoxicating as the hardest of hardcore narcotics. Its payoff is incapacity. When we fail, we are off the hook. We have given ourselves a get-out-of-jail-free card. We no longer have to ask and answer Stanislavski's famous three questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What do I want? 24. Addicted to sex. If addictions and shadow careers are metaphors, sex is the richest one of all and the most difficult to decode. Why are we obsessed with sex? Does sex represent conquest or surrender? Are we seeking the oblivion of orgasm or the transcendence of escaping the ego? Is union with another our goal, or are we seeking to dominate or humiliate our partner? Is sex about love? Are we seeking a soulmate, a mother slash father? Are we trying to reach God? I don't see what all the fuss about sex is, said the comedian. It's only friction. My own theory is that the obsessive pursuit of sex is an attempt to obliterate the ego, i.e. normal consciousness, the monkey mind that tortures us with restlessness, fear, anger, and self-centeredness. We're trying to get to the level above that. The entity we're seeking union with is ourselves. We're trying to connect with our true being, our soul, our self. 25. Addicted to distraction. Resistance hates two qualities above all others, concentration and depth. Why? Because when we work with focus and we work deep, we succeed. How did Tom Brady master the art of the forward pass? How did Picasso paint? How did Yo-Yo Ma learn the cello? Resistance wants to keep us shallow and unfocused, so it makes the superficial and the vain intoxicating. Have you checked your email in the last half hour? When you sit down to do your work, do you leave your web connection on? It can be fatal, keeping up with the Kardashians. 26. Addicted to money. The real utility of money is its convenience as a medium of exchange. If you and I have a goat in Smyrna, we don't have to carry the poor beast in our arms all the way to Aleppo to trade it for a carpet. We can sell the goat in Smyrna, stash a silver derrick in our pocket, and take the derrick to Aleppo to buy the carpet. But when we're addicted to money, we become hooked on the metaphor. Is money how we keep score? Is it magic? Is wealth a currency that opens doors, realizes possibilities, produces transcendence? Money is second only to sex in the richness of its metaphor. But as in the case of carnality, our real object is the currency of our own hearts. The same premise applies to power, fame, and all other external expressions of potency. What you and I are really seeking is our own voice, our own truth, our own authenticity. 27. Addicted to trouble. There are more than 2 million people behind bars in the United States and another 5 million on probation or parole. How many millions more are self-imprisoned in cycles of abuse of others or of themselves, or habituated to other forms of vice, corruption, and depravity? Why is trouble so intoxicating? Because its payoff is incapacity. The scars and tattoos of the convict are his shadow symphony, his displaced epic, his unpainted masterpiece. The individual addicted to trouble will never get out of jail because he is safer behind bars than free out in the world. Each time he is released, he will find a way to get sent back. The payoff for the prisoner is release from the agonizing imperative of identifying, embracing, and bringing into material existence the dreams and visions of his own deepest, noblest, and most honorable heart. 28. My Year of Turning Pro. I was 31. I had saved up $2,700 and moved from New York City to a little town in Northern California. I rented a house behind another house for $105 a month. I had my old Chevy van, my Smith Corona typewriter, and my cat, Mo. Every Monday morning, I walked into the village to the Bank of America and took out 25 bucks. That sum lasted me for the next 7 days. I didn't talk to anybody during my year of turning pro. I didn't hang out. I just worked. I had a book in mind, and I had decided I would finish it or kill myself. I could not run away again or let people down again or let myself down again. This was it, do or die. I had no TV, no radio, no music, no sex, no sports. I didn't read the newspaper. For breakfast, I had liver and eggs. I was like Rocky. In the early mornings, I'd walk down River Road to my friend Paul Rink's house, which was actually a camper shell mounted on a pickup. Paul was a writer. He'd been a friend of Henry Miller's and Big Sur. Paul taught me what books to read and what writers to pay attention to. That was what I did at night. I read all the stuff that you're supposed to read in college but never do, or if you do, you're not paying attention. I read Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Turgenev. I read Cervantes and Flaubert and Stendhal and Knut Hamsun, and I read every American except Faulkner. I was writing on my ancient Smith Corona, which had a heavy carriage that physically shuttled back and forth as you typed. My cat, Mo, would curl up on the desk on the left side of the typewriter so that the carriage would pass over his head back and forth as I typed. It didn't seem to bother him. When I ran out of money at the end of my time, I went to pick apples in Washington State. That was when I met Dave and Jack. When the season was over, I had cleared $250 after paying rent, gas, and engine repairs. I drove south and got back to work on the book. One day I typed, "The End." That's the moment in the war of art when I knew I had beaten resistance. I had finished something. The manuscript didn't find a publisher, and it shouldn't have. It wasn't good enough. I had to go back to a real job in advertising in New York and save up again and quit again and write another book that also didn't find a publisher because it also wasn't good enough. Neither were the 9 screenplays I wrote over the next X years, I can't even remember how many, before I finally got my first check for $3,500 and promptly went back to writing more screenplays that I also couldn't sell. During that first year, I sometimes thought to myself, "Steve, you've got it lucky now. No distractions. You can focus full time. What are you going to do when life gets complicated again?" In the end, it didn't matter. That year made me a pro. It gave me, for the first time in my life, an uninterrupted stretch of month after month that was mine alone, that nobody knew about but me, when I was truly productive, truly facing my demons, and truly working my shit. That year has stuck with me. 29. The Pain of Being Human. The Gnostics believed that exile was the essential condition of man. Do you agree? I do. The artist and the addict both wrestle with this experience of exile. They share an acute, even excruciating sensitivity to the state of separation and isolation, and both actively seek a way to overcome it, to transcend it, or at least to make the pain go away. What is the pain of being human? It's the condition of being suspended between two worlds and being unable to fully enter into either. As mortal flesh, you and I cannot ascend to the upper realm. That sphere belongs to the gods. But we can't put it out of our minds either. we can't escape intimations and half-memories of what? Some prior sojourn before birth, perhaps, among the immortals or the stars? Our lot, instead, is to dwell here in the lower realm, the sphere of the temporal and the material, the time-bound dimension of instincts and animal passions, of hate and desire, aspiration and fear. You and I are called to the upper realm, and it is calling to us, but we're having a pretty good time sometimes down here in the sphere of the senses. Bottom line, we're marooned in the middle, stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. 30. Jewish despair and Irish despair. If you'll forgive me for quoting myself, here's a passage from Killing Rommel. In the story, a poet and Oxford tutor, Zachary Stein, makes the distinction between two types of despair. Jewish despair arises from want and can be cured by surfeit. Give a penniless Jew 50 quid and he perks right up. Irish despair is different. Nothing relieves Irish despair. The Irishman's complaint lies not with his circumstances, which might be rendered brilliant by labor or luck, but with the injustice of existence itself. Death. How could a benevolent deity gift us with life only to set such a cruel term upon it? Irish despair knows no remedy. Money can't help, love fades, fame is fleeting. The only cures are booze and sentiment. That's why the Irish are such noble drunks and glorious poets. No one sings like the Irish or mourns like them. Why? Because they're angels imprisoned in vessels of flesh. It's not just the Irish. The pain of being human is that we're all angels imprisoned in vessels of flesh. 31. The Pain of Being Human, Part 2. The addict seeks to escape the pain of being human in one of two ways, by transcending it or by anesthetizing it. Born aloft by powerful enough chemicals, we can almost, if we're lucky, glimpse the face of the infinite. If that doesn't work, we can always pass out. Both ways work, the pain goes away. The artist takes a different tack. She tries to reach the upper realm not by chemicals, but by labor and love. When I say artist, I mean as well the lover, the holy man, the engineer, the mother, the warrior, the inventor, the singer, the sage, and the voyager. And remember, addict and artist can be one and the same, and often are, moment to moment. If the upper realm, as Plato suggested, is the sphere of perfect love, truth, justice, and beauty, then the artist seeks to call down the magic of this world and to create, by dint of labor and luck, the closest to sublime simulacra of those qualities that he or she can. This pursuit produces, for the artist, peace of mind. Book 2, Self-Inflicted Wounds. 32, Accidental Incapacitation. During the trench warfare in World War I, it was a not uncommon phenomenon for soldiers to take their rifles and literally shoot themselves in the foot. The troopers would claim that the shooting was accidental. They were hoping to get sent to the hospital and thus excused from duty. They did this to avoid the carnage that was waiting for them when the order came to go over the top, i.e., to mount out of the trenches and charge across no man's land into the machine gun fire of the enemy. In the military, to deliberately inflict injury upon oneself so as to avoid service is called malingering. It's a court-martial offense that is punishable in some armies by death. The habits and addictions of the amateur are conscious or unconscious self-inflicted wounds. Their payoff is incapacity. When we take our M1903 Springfield and blow a hole in our foot, we no longer have to face the real fight of our lives, which is to become who we are and to realize our destiny and our calling. 33. A Definition of the Amateur. The amateur is young and dumb. He's innocent, he's good-hearted, he's well-intentioned. The amateur is brave, he's inventive and resourceful, he's willing to take a chance. Like Luke Skywalker, the amateur harbors noble aspirations. He has dreams. He seeks liberation and enlightenment. And he's willing, he hopes, to pay the price. The amateur is not evil or crazy. He's not deluded. He's not demented. The amateur is trying to learn. The amateur is you and me. What exactly is an amateur? How does an amateur view himself and the world? What qualities characterize the amateur? 34. The amateur is terrified. Fear is the primary color of the amateur's interior world. Fear of failure, fear of success, fear of looking foolish, fear of underachieving and fear of overachieving, fear of poverty, fear of loneliness, fear of death. But mostly, what we all fear as amateurs is being excluded from the tribe, i.e. the gang, the posse, mother and father, family, nation, race, religion. The amateur fears that if he turns pro and lives out his calling, he will have to live up to who he really is and what he is truly capable of. The amateur is terrified that if the tribe should discover who he really is, he will be kicked out into the cold to die. 35. The professional is terrified too. The professional, by the way, is just as terrified as the amateur. In fact, the professional may be more terrified because she is more acutely conscious of herself and of her interior universe. The difference lies in the way the professional acts in the face of fear. 36. The amateur is an egotist. The amateur identifies with his own ego. He believes he is himself. That's why he's terrified. The amateur is a narcissist. He views the world hierarchically. He continuously rates himself in relation to others, becoming self-inflated if his fortunes rise and desperately anxious if his star should fall. The amateur sees himself as the hero, not only of his own movie, but of the movies of others. He insists, in his own mind, if nowhere else, that others share this view. The amateur competes with others and believes that he cannot rise unless a competitor falls. If he had the power, the amateur would eat the world, even knowing that to do so would mean his own extinction. 37. The amateur lives by the opinions of others. Though the amateur's identity is seated in his own ego, that ego is so weak that it cannot define itself based on its own self-evaluation. The amateur allows his worth and identity to be defined by others. The amateur craves third-party validation. The amateur is tyrannized by his imagined conception of what is expected of him. He is imprisoned by what he believes he ought to think, how he ought to look, what he ought to do, and who he ought to be. 38. The amateur permits fear to stop him from acting. Paradoxically, the amateur's self-inflation prevents him from acting. He takes himself and the consequences of his actions so seriously that he paralyzes himself. The amateur fears above all else becoming and being seen and judged as himself. Becoming himself means being different from others and thus possibly violating the expectations of the tribe, without whose acceptance and approval he believes he cannot survive. By these means, the amateur remains inauthentic. He remains someone other than who he really is. 39. The amateur is easily distracted. The amateur has a long list of fears. Near the top are two: solitude and silence. The amateur fears solitude and silence because she needs to avoid at all costs the voice inside her head that would point her toward her calling and her destiny. So she seeks distraction. The amateur prizes shallowness and shuns depth. The culture of Twitter and Facebook is paradise for the amateur. 40. The amateur seeks instant gratification. There was a popular bumper sticker a few years ago, "Too much ain't enough." Too much ain't enough, and too soon is too late. The amateur, the addict, and the obsessive all want what they want now.